who art in a penthouse sits in his 37th floor, sweet and swivels to gaze down at the city he made me in. He allows me to stand and solicit graffiti until he needs the land I stand on. And
welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or, if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. Poverty has a lot in common with war. Everyone says they don't want it, people die from it, and no matter how much the politicians promise to eradicate it, we still wind up with plenty of it. But there are differences, too. Everyone knows some people profit from war, but who profits from poverty? That's a question we'll be asking right after this.
He sends us little pieces of paper, I don't ask, I just empty my pockets and wait.
In a time when city and state budgets are being squeezed and homelessness is on the rise, agencies that serve the homeless are trying to do more with less. We take a look at the lack of resources for the homeless in this second part of a two-part series set in Western Massachusetts. Bill Miller, who directs several programs for the homeless in Northampton, Massachusetts.
The whole notion of subsidies is being debated and cut federally. More pressure is put on the states to come up with money. The states have less money.
Most shelters close down during the day. That means that a bed just for the night is usually the best a single homeless person can find. And even that can get scarce. The only refuge for homeless individuals in Springfield is frequently overcrowded. Advocates claim it is unhealthy and dangerous, conditions that have sometimes discouraged the homeless from taking refuge there. Last winter, two men froze to death because they refused to stay in the shelter.
It's not adequate. We began meeting with the city and pushing them to make an emergency response. When they didn't move quickly enough, the open pantry stepped in and started something called the warming place. Again, it was only an overnight shelter, but it's for the folks that couldn't deal with the overcrowded conditions at Worthington Street Shelter.
When budgets are squeezed, programs end up competing for a smaller slice of the pie. The squeeze comes in from all directions. In addition to scarce beds and shelters, local homeless families compete for temporary apartments. When the state has too little funding for housing the homeless, it may limit access to these scarce services. Homeless families have to get a referral from the Department of Transitional Assistance in order to get a temporary emergency apartment. Marion Hone of Western Mass Legal Services in Springfield.
Those referrals have become harder and harder to get for families.
Families have to be at or below the federal poverty income level, a level that most poverty experts feel is set too low. They are barred from emergency housing if they have ever been evicted from subsidized housing for non-payment of rent, or if they have been evicted for criminal activity, even if the family member responsible no longer lives with the family.
So the regulations in and of themselves present certain hurdles for families that the family has to cross in order to get into shelter. But what we also see is that there's a growing trend at the Department of Transitional Assistance to interpret the regulations in a way which oftentimes defies common sense. The department oftentimes actually uses the regulations to keep families out of shelter.
Homeless advocates agree that the squeeze on resources won't get better until more permanent, affordable housing is available to all those who need it.
We know that shelter isn't really the solution. You know, what we want is more affordable housing in this city, and we want the mayor and the city to figure out what the population of Springfield needs and then design housing stock to meet those needs.
That's going to take money. Bill Miller.
It comes back to what are we going to agree that our taxes are worth spending on, and, you know, is housing something that taxpayers should support? Again, you know, housing's expensive. It's not getting any cheaper. It's absolutely killer for people who are poor.
Meanwhile, in Springfield, the threat of homelessness in that city hasn't lessened. It looks like the tent city outside the Open Pantry might have to open for a second season this spring.
Anyone can be homeless less than a heartbeat. You know, should it be something by nature or something by a man-made disaster? You know, someone going to have a fire. The fire downstairs can start down there. You're homeless living upstairs, so anyone can be homeless less than a heartbeat.
For the Homeless Marathon, this is Francesca Rhiannon.
Everybody, it's me, Nobody. Welcome back to the third hour of the Homelessness Marathon. And let me tell you, out here in New Haven, we're on the street in New Haven behind the Columbus House shelter. And it's fairly warm, actually. I don't know what it is. High 30s would be a guess. But it's raining. It's raining. And that means when I'm outside, even between the broadcast booth and I go back inside during the breaks or something, I'm getting wet. It makes it chillier. It makes it harder to be out here, to be warm. And I really want to remind people who are listening that there are a lot of people tonight who are in doorways, who are God knows where, in cellars, in basements, in any kind of place in this rain. There are people who are in cardboard boxes, in parks, or in empty vacant lots. And that's a lot of the reason why these booths are outside, why we do this from outside. We really want to draw attention to that. These are not good circumstances for people to be out in. And certainly, this is a fundamental point of this broadcast. We really ought to be thinking about what it means for people to be out in weather like this. And of course, 38 degrees and raining in the winter, that's good weather. And yet, who'd want to be out in it? This hour of the broadcast is probably the most controversial hour because we're going to ask a question that you don't really ever hear asked on a national broadcast. You barely ever even hear it asked in a private conversation. And the question we're going to ask is, who profits from poverty? We are often told that the poor are poor because of their own failings, they're all drunks, or they're all of this. In fact, after the first hour, when I had those three lovely women in the booth, Leslie at the end said, well, I got my point across, but I really wanted to stress, I'm not homeless because I'm a drug addict, I'm homeless because I lost my job. We always want to blame the poor for their own condition, but there are people who maybe make money out of other people's poverty, and that is a question we are going to talk about tonight. And on the phone with me is Frank Morales, who is an Episcopal priest, an activist, and the author of the book Police State America. Frank, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
How you doing? Nice to be here.
Well, it's very good to have you here, Frank. Now, when we talk about, I know we all have a different slant on this. I've got points I want to make about this too. But when we talk about who profits from poverty, it seems impossible that anybody would. And yet, do you think that somebody does?
Oh, well, I mean, the roots of homelessness have to do both with economic factors. We're talking about homeless as well as factors that have to do with social control. But let's focus on the economic factors primarily. Obviously, real estate has a lot to gain in gentrifying neighborhoods. You know, but this is a big question that's hard to answer in a quick interview. But nonetheless, there are forces of displacement, whether it's arson for profit or banks which disinvest from neighborhoods, small developers who are looking to make a buck and want to push people out. There's various reasons why people face displacement, which is an economic motive. But primarily, a general answer to the question is, people are made homeless. Homeless people are really former tenants, if you think of it that way, who've become impoverished, or as part of the general condition economic motives. But we need to understand that these economic motives, and whether we're talking big developers, little developers, speculators, people who make money off speculating on land, make money on renting out buildings that have been paid for over and over the course of the last five, six, seven decades. A lot of the buildings down here on the Lower East Side obviously have been paid for. The whole business of speculating on land, which is referred to as real estate, is at root the problem. But to, you know, we focus it more directly on the short-term profits and long-term profits of gentrification. Gentrification being pushing out poor people out of a neighborhood forcefully, covertly, some not so covert, and you know, speculating on the land and making money, profiting off of the displacement, the suffering of the poor, which is well documented in hospital records here in New York that point to, you know, a shorter life expectancy of people who are homeless, the susceptibility to AIDS and TB and other things
that are,
you know, much more...
But the first point that you're making, Frank, is that it is, if the housing costs or if housing becomes unavailable, it's more expensive than poor people can pay, that means somebody is making more money off of the housing by renting it to richer clients.
Sure.
Basically. So there's money to be made.
You know, there's not a lot of money in providing housing for homeless people, ironically, or poor people. Ironically, it gets so twisted and obscene in a way, because you have a situation like a welfare hotel, in which these are hotels where poor people are forced to pay outrageous rents, usually paid through welfare in the old days, but not even so much that now, for a small room wherein it would be cheaper for welfare to pay for an affordable apartment, and they could, people could live in an apartment. So the point being is that it's not only about economic motives, there are other factors. Some of the factors that we, as you know, part of our movement down here, particularly back in the 80s and throughout the 90s, in the squatter movement, pointed out was that there are motives of social control. When communities, and particularly poor communities, begin to organize and get together around a whole host of issues, whether it's school or housing or health care or sanitation pickup or jobs or whatever it is, environment, part of the attack on, and I call it an attack on people's housing, particularly poor people's housing, through raising the rents and displacing them and arson and all these evictions, is an attack on people's ability to organize around their self-interest.
Well, because their neighborhoods are destroyed.
Yeah. There's a social control motive, and I'm not just saying this. I think we can document this, particularly if people look at the studies that were done in the 60s and 70s by the federal government around dissent in the cities. And they pointed out that there needed to be a dispersal of poor people from the inner cities.
You're talking about the Kerner Commission report?
The Kerner Commission report.
Which was, for anybody who doesn't know, was published after the riots, the Long Island Summer.
Chapter 17, I think it is, of the Kerner Commission report, which deals with housing. Now, one might ask, well, why are we discussing housing within the context of so-called civil disorder? And it's not that they recommended, well, let's build housing for poor people in those communities. It recommends dispersing the poor from the urban centers in order to alleviate the pressure of this resistance.
So there wouldn't be a critical mass.
We
should point out that, you know, it's not just through high rents, people profiting from high rents, which is a real phenomenon, pushing poor people out and raising the rents. That's not the only way poor people are dispersed. City after city has torn down single-room occupancy housing or flop houses to make room for convention centers, to make room for stadiums, to make room for office buildings, things that, in the parlance, return more revenue to the city's tax base, but which really, in common English, just means they make more money by throwing the poor people out, destroying their neighborhoods, and building something more expensive in its place.
Exactly. There are more homeless people today than there were in the late 80s in New York City now. That's one fact. And the other thing is that there are absolutely none, I mean zero, single room occupancy, small rooms that are affordable to single people who don't have a lot of money, poor people, working poor people, people, you know, who are caught between one check and the next. That kind of situation it's been drastically reduced to the point where you would think that, you know, the only solution that's being put forth by the administration, whether it's municipal or federal, are more prisons or these so-called shelters, which are, you know, against laws of habitability, housing laws.
Mm-hmm,
but they skirt that by calling them shelters, so that these barracks, where people are put in, are centers of transmission of all sorts of illnesses, and it's a low-intensity form of detention. I think anybody would see that people have to come in. And
this is what we're giving to poor people.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a police solution of poverty, which is the way in which it was put by one of the architects in the Kerner Commission who figured this whole housing scheme. They call it planned shrinkage now. In other words, they're economic motives, but one shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's not only economic motives that cause homelessness. There's a tie-in to motives of social control.
All right. Now, I thought I had my other co-host on the line. We're having a little trouble with our phones here at the moment. So, let's just continue on with this discussion.
Well, another way that people, you know, should realize that poverty is maintained and housing is not produced and so forth is this whole notion of redlining. And people are not as aware of this. But, for instance, a landlord generally doesn't make money on the rents that poor people pay in a building. It could be that it may be difficult to meet the costs of oil and maintenance on the building, et cetera, through rents alone. This might, in fact, be the case, and this is what you often hear landlords say. They make the money through refinancing their mortgage at the local bank. They go in, they say, the building has accrued in value, and so on. I won't go through all the details, but essentially, the money is to be made working with the banks. When banks in the 70s, for example, late 70s, surrounding the South Bronx, and in the South Bronx, decided not to grant any loans or refinancing to small owners in the Bronx, it completely led to the decimation of whole areas in the Bronx.
Okay, so let me break you off there, Frank, for a second, because obviously you're making the point that what looks like a random pattern of poverty is not so random.
It's not an act of God.
No, okay, all right, but I want to stop there because we have another co-host on the line that we had trouble picking up, and so I want to shift the discussion over. I'm very delighted to have now on the phone Francis Fox Piven, who is the author of numerous books, including The Breaking of the American Social Compact, and most recently, The War at Home, The Domestic Costs of Bush's Militarism. Francis Fox Piven, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Glad to talk to you.
Well, I'm glad we finally were able to get you. You have used a phrase, which I'm sure that Frank, who's the other co-host, will recognize, but you've used a phrase, the politics of plunder. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that government public policy over the last 25 years has been steadily readjusted, changed, reshaped, so as to increase profits at the expense of wages and living conditions. Homelessness is one effect of that broad pattern. There are some 30 million people working in the United States who cannot afford a one-bedroom apartment in their county. You know, there are two sides of the homelessness equation. One side has to do with the costs of housing, and those have, as your other guest, Frank Morales, has been saying, those costs have been steadily going up. Rents are too high, partly because of the pressure of gentrification. You can tear down the SROs or just the low rental housing that once was available to low-wage earners or to poor people, or maybe you won't tear it down. Maybe you'll renovate it and make it quaint and cute, so that better-off people will pay the high rents. At the same time, government has been eliminating the housing subsidy programs that were begun in the New Deal and expanded in the 1960s. Those programs are virtually gone now. So there are no subsidies that will make this raging, fevered real estate market accessible to low-wage workers. Meanwhile, wages have not been rising, especially wages have not been rising for people in the bottom half of the labor market or people who are out of the labor market for one reason or another. So we have, you know, it's not rocket science. If you don't pay people enough to buy housing on these in this kind of fevered market, you're going to get homelessness. And there are, you know, other factors that enter into it too. People who lose their jobs because factories shut down, they go to the south or they go abroad. So that some people are hit by particular kinds of changes. But the broad pattern of the American economy has been to exert tremendous pressure on the wages of many, many workers. This is not a problem that is just hitting a few people or a narrow stratum of the population. This is lots of people can't earn enough to buy housing on this market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. This is a call-in, John. I've got a call I very much want to take. The numbers to call in here are 877-NOBODY-8, and that's the word nobody in the number 8. Anyone can call that number, homeless or housed. And we have a special line for people who are homeless or formerly homeless or about to be homeless, which you can call in addition, and that's 866-LEFT-OUT. On the line, we have a gentleman by the name of Philip who is actually calling from inside of a tent in New Haven in the rain. Philip, are you there? Philip.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon, Philip.
Hi, this isn't Philip.
Who are you?
Nobody. My name is Sean.
Sean, I recognize your voice. And, well, Philip, I'm sorry, but Sean, I'm happy to have you, and you're on the phone with Francis Fox Piven and Frank Morales. What's on your mind tonight, Sean?
Two thoughts that came to mind with profit and homelessness. When people are homeless, they tend to go into they tend to end up as social control. They tend to end up in some form of criminal justice system. I've known three people now who have been homeless at some point and have been part of the two and a half million now, is it? 2.25 in the American criminal justice empire. And back in the 90s, it's nothing new with prisons for profit. And there are all kinds of ways that people make money off of the American criminal justice matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And the other
well, stop right there. Stop right there, Sean. Frank or Francis, does one of you want to jump in about people making money off of prisons?
Well, we have, as part of a kind of broad drive to privatize government services, we've been privatizing prisons. And increasingly, prisoners are put to work for private employers as well. So, yeah, Sean is making a good point. That's another way that homelessness is connected to the profits that are made from poor people. But there's a step in the train of causes that Sean did not mention. When people become homeless, it's very difficult to lead a normal routine, regular, conventional life. And that means that they're much more exposed to the agents of criminal justice, to the cops. So they're much more likely to find themselves entangled in with the judicial, with the police system in one way or another.
Sean?
Yeah, and they often end up also in emergency in hospital emergency rooms, which it's not profitable for the hospital itself, but for medical services companies, it's the medical industry is well known. Once you get yourself out of homelessness, if you're lucky enough to manage, then there's a whole another tier of vultures that will quote unquote help you if you're in a house, but it's an empty house. You've got no furniture, you've got no car, you've got nothing with which to keep this house. And there's a well-documented payday loan industry. There's all kinds of people that want to prey on your meager little earned income bribe or credit, whichever way you want to define it. And there's in my area, the rent-to-own industry has exploded. And it seems like it when Walmart came in. They and the dollar stores came in about the same, not too long afterwards, like Remora on Sharks. And that's a whole other level of profit right there. People pay. You see, in my area, the law says you have to have the cash price on the item, and people are buying these things for a cash price which is two or three or four times what the retail price is.
Right, and because you're poor. Sean, I'm going to cut you off right there because we just got other things to do.
I understand.
But, Sean, people don't know this who are out there listening. You used to be a regular caller when I had a weekly show in upstate New York, and may I just say it's a pleasure to hear your voice again.
Nice hearing you after all these years.
Yeah, it sure is nice. Nice talking to you, Sean, and thank you for calling.
Bye.
Frank, did you want to comment on that last point, people who are ripping off the poor with loans, medical care, things, all kinds of ways?
I think what he points out is the, numerous ways that what we used to refer to as poverty pimps, seek to exploit poor people. There's the whole psychopharmaceutical industry, which has come in and diagnosed people with all sorts of illnesses. Mind you, people who are living on the streets tend to suffer, psychological conditions and so forth. But it's a kind of, and he says, uses that term vulture, kind of an attitude. So you have all this kind of drug pushing on people.
Well, as a matter of fact, we now have forced drugging of homeless people in some places.
Yeah, outpatient forced.
And that is profitable for the people selling the drugs. It's sold as a social important thing.
When you think of it, in some ways, the whole system we live in is geared towards exploiting poor people in one way or another, whether it's poor people who are forced to fight in wars, so that big oil companies and others can maintain their profits, whether it's poor people who are forced to make things in prison, homeless people and others who are barely, homeless and are back out there trying to survive. It's a form of indentured servitude in a way, isn't it?
Now, of course, you're talking in terms that
made earlier. It has to do with why are they doing this? We need to ask a more basic question. Why are they forcing people? They don't want people to be powerful. They don't want people to organize and to better themselves. So, this whole thing is their economic motives and their economic rewards that are obscene in exploiting poor people. But we need to remember that the political motivations for this are to keep people down. When the people were organizing in the 60s, you didn't see a lot of homeless people on the streets. I mean, it was a different class of homeless people. The whole history of homelessness is shifted from that period, in which case, by the mid-70s and late 70s, certainly, you saw a lot of people who maybe at one point, if you think in terms of black people and Latinos, were part of liberation movements in the urban centers.
Right.
And you need to look deeply into these motivations and see the kind of state repression aspect to homelessness and the shelter system, which is coordinated, by the way, I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but you can look it up. The shelter system nationally for homeless people is coordinated by FEMA, which is now part of the Homeland Security apparatus.
Right.
See it as an emergency, but really, if you look deeply, it's not an emergency that we would consider a human rights issue or a crisis of humanity in terms of people suffering on the streets or economic injustice. But it's an emergency of maintaining and suppressing populations that might otherwise if they were able to, if they had a home from which to organize their lives and to seek better jobs and better health care and so forth, we need to look more deeply at those motives as well. But
okay.
Surely, you know, if there's a way to rip off the poor people, they seem to be fully...
Find a need and fill it, as they say. Let's take a break from this discussion for just a moment, because I have a gentleman at the mic who wants to read a poem or two, and that is something we very much encourage here on the Homelessness Marathon, because poetry is a poor person's medium, and we want to encourage it as an art form. So let's take a quick break, and at the mic, what's your name, sir?
My name is Mark.
Mark, you want to read a poem or two real quick?
Yeah.
Thank you.
My poem is called Rainless Oblivion. Wow, I'm so sick of doubt. My wings feel as if they're clipped. I see them when I sleep, angels without wings, trying to cocoon somewhere safe, away from streets stained red, far from screeching sirens and stick-up kids. Life at this stage is hard knocks and sometimes depression. I have hope for the future, though. Dreams, my body is down right now, though. My mind is in the stars. I'm watching the clock at every minute, waiting for my body to catch up. I see little strewn streets, and my brain is set in survival mode. This is where addiction can take you, away from all normalcy. I feel sometimes I'm locked in the prison of oppression, left my life for the life of the hustles. Sometimes love can creep in, though, and alas, it's in here that maybe I will fall. I only wish that I had a life preserver. At times there is many problems. We can blame it on the system, but that only goes so far. Is it really their fault, or is it ours? Every person has their own story, though. 90% of the time it's drugs. Maybe I'm wrong. Sometimes it starts out as simple entertainment, and then it grows into a full-blown monster, content at eating away at everything and everybody in its path. I guess you can never really see it coming, though. It seems so innocent at the time, and then we find ourselves so powerless and washed up. And at the end, we find ourselves with no home and no loved ones. At the end, it's just you. The ball falls in your court. At the end, it's on you. Sometimes we love too much. Our hearts grow big, and rain can cloud our vision. Our eyes become misty, and we feel as if we would do anything for the one we love, even follow them down the garden path. At this time, we can love ourselves. We can only love ourselves and the one we love. At this time, we can be led down the garden path away from our existence and find that life that we need to love ourselves first, and that only then can we love somebody else and give them the full heart and banquet of love they deserve. I give my whole life a time to relationship. I think that's part of my story, a relationship and then drugs. And at the end, I found it would just be me at the end, shaking, hands on an empty heart. I cannot contain my emotions. They're unfortunately locked outside of me, and I found my insides with pain. I wish there was an easier way. Could be found. I wish. My dreams will catch up, I know. I'm homeless right now, but I'm not without hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us. And listen, let's go right away to our next call, who we lost before. We got Philip calling from the tent in the rain. Philip, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Philip, you're calling from a tent in New Haven?
Yeah, I live in a tent community called Seven Feathers down in New Haven. And we've been living here. This is my second winter running this camp. And I work full-time, by the way. So it's got nothing to do with being lazy. I know some people think that homeless people are lazy. They don't want to work. I've been working full-time for the last 8 months. And I spent like $2,000 down in this camp getting it ready. But I can't save enough money to make the rent down here in New Haven. I mean, it is expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, talking about trying to get a security deposit, and then people put you through references, you know, because I'm an ex-con. You know, so it's hard to get into places, you know, down here in New Haven. If you're trying to get a rent somewhere decent, I mean, I could rent a room somewhere, but then it's full of drug addicts and stuff. My camp is a camp of recovery, by the way. You know what I'm saying? We only take people that's, you know, recovering from drugs or, you know, trying to recover from drugs. So
how many,
you know,
people are in it?
Excuse me?
How many people are in your camp?
Well, right now I got 5 people down here right this minute. But we usually take 6 people in and then a 7th one. That's why it's called 7-7. Because we got 6 people down here off from work. I got some kind of income so you can pay for their own heat. You know, because we run, our tents are heated and insulated. You know what I'm saying? They're pretty big, 18 by 10. So every 18 by 10 tent. One person, it's about half the size of a living room, but you know, it's comfortable. It's better than living in the shelter. I mean, I have nothing against the shelters. You know, the shelters are for some people, but down here we have our own independence. We make our own schedule. You know what I'm saying? We're able to come and go as we please. We don't have to carry our clothes on our backs. But we're the few lucky ones in New Haven. I mean, there's a lot of people in New Haven not as fortunate as us. You know, they can't find a good spot to pitch a tent because it's illegal to pitch a tent in New Haven, Connecticut. If you think about pitching a tent in New Haven, cops will come and tear it down.
How are you getting away with it? You're hidden, that's it, okay.
We're so well hidden that they haven't found us. We've been down here 2 years. You know, so we're making it. But who wants to live in a tent? I mean, you know, America's supposed to be such a great country. I mean, the rents are so high. It should be a way where someone like me that's working full time, you know what I'm saying, and is willing to work, can afford a rent. I mean, I'm only getting paid $7.10 an hour. I'm not getting paid a whole lot of money. So I can't spend. If I pay rent to someone, I have nothing. I can't wash my clothes. I won't be able to eat. I mean, I won't have any money for anything, you know. So, but living down in this tent, it gives me money to wash my clothes. I can eat out anytime I want. I can buy new clothes if I feel like. I can go to the movies like a normal person, you know. I can go bowling and bring my girlfriend bowling if I choose to, you know. So living in a tent gives me freedom, you know. But I don't want to be in a tent for the rest of my life.
I hear you. Francis, yeah. You have a question here for Philip, maybe?
No, but I think that Philip has captured the situation very, very well. I mean, here he is. He's working full-time. He's earning $7.10 an hour, which is a lot above the minimum wage. I mean, that's a lot of people who are working for less. But he's right. He can't afford the rent of a one-bedroom apartment. And unless he, you know, just gives away his paycheck and doesn't have enough money to see a doctor once in a while, to eat decently, to do his laundry. So that's the problem. That's why we have, that's a big part of the homelessness problem. It's not the whole part of it, but it's a big part of the homelessness. If we solve that part of the problem, then we could turn to what remains.
You know, I'd like to make a little contribution here because this is actually an issue I've written about a bit. And when I was a boy in New York City, there were flop houses for people who were, you know, but there are people who get drunk and they're in the gutter. But nonetheless, when I was a boy, they could raise a quarter and you could get a bed in a flop house. If you got 50 cents, you got it was called a lion's house. That was the upscale flop house. Today, I on the reliable testimony of a junkie, former junkie I know that the cheapest hotel room in the city is about $35. So the cost of the cheapest lodging for the most marginal people in the city has gone up 140-fold. Mm. So we can all just think about that. If we're paying $500 a month, what would it mean if we went from $500 a month to paying $70,000 a month? That's what that rent increase means for the poorest of the poor. And that is because they tore down that housing in New York City to make other kinds of more upscale enterprises.
And it's all gone. The only place where there's that kind of housing now is in the outer boroughs, where they are reproducing the conditions of the Lower East Side in the 19th century, dividing up apartments, dividing up attics and cellars and garages, jamming families and single people, but a lot of families as well, into these bizarre, crummy living conditions, and charging high rents for them.
All right. Well, Philip, what would you like to say? You know, I'm going to have to move on because we got to open up a line here. But I want to hear just a little more about what you're saying, especially this issue of autonomy and freedom that you have there. A lot of homeless people are moving into tent communities or trying to make these kinds of things work because they feel it gives them something better than what they could otherwise have. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the only thing I want to say, and is the people that's not homeless and think that everybody that's homeless is a drug addict or drunk or lazy, that's not true. Everybody that's homeless is not a drug addict, a drunk, and an alcoholic. Some of us are just poor. We can't afford to live the way that they live. We don't get the job, you know, we don't get the job that's going to pay us the money to get a home. And as far as the as being free, I mean, don't get me wrong, the shelter saved my life. But I want something more, you know, and I enjoy my freedom. I enjoy being able to move the way I want to move and not carry my clothes on my back. And that's basically all I want to say. But I want to point out that everybody that's living a homeless life is not necessarily a bad person. We're just in a bad situation.
Well, that's why we do this broadcast. I am so glad you said that, and I'm so glad you called in. Thank you very much, Phil.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's really inspiring to hear what they're doing. We articulated that kind of feeling back in the late 80s. We seized 30 buildings down here on the Lower East Side, and we're still in 11 of them. And if people don't, you know, we're referred to as squatters, but really it's more elemental than that. It's what Philip was talking about is, you know, the desire and the need for freedom and the ability and the discipline and the courage to go about and seize it. And in terms of homeless people, we need to look at the fact that 3/4 of the world's poor, according to the Office of Human Settlements at the United Nations, which studies these things, the housing that they're currently, this is 3/4 of the world's poor, are living in housing currently that they made themselves. So what Philip represents is the dominant form of self-help housing all around the planet. And I think what we're going to be seeing more is a lot more, I refer to it as squatting because I think that's what it is. People are seizing the freedom through their, you know, exercising their freedom. They're making the human right to a home real by action. They're not living in some abstract realm. They're taking what they need.
And for people who are unfamiliar with it, and I think that's a lot of people, they should understand that the squatters movement is a very strong movement. It's going, I mean, I don't know how strong I would compare it to what, but this is going on all around the United States today. You're not the only guy who's doing it.
Frank, where are you doing this?
On the Lower East Side.
Of New York?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. I'm in New York, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we will have later on Sherry Honkala of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which is doing the same strategy in Philadelphia. We just had Ivy calling in from San Francisco saying she was squatting for 5 years. This is going on both on an organized and on an individual kind of ad hoc basis all around.
Yeah, I think that when people realize that there's no solution through this government, these administrations, that the only way that poor people are going to get the housing is if they create it themselves. They organize and they defend one another. And they create space. They see public space as a terrain for struggle. They go and build things and take over abandoned things, you know, spaces and so forth. And it's hard work and so on. But I think what Philip was reflecting, and I think you could hear it in his voice, was the real joy in getting together with your friends and your neighbors and positively impacting on you know, the conditions that people are living in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, building housing together, making it. Whether it's a heated tent, whether it's getting into an abandoned building and renovating the thing for your own sweat and labor. And again, this is the dominant form of the way that people all around the world are, unfortunately, maybe fortunately and unfortunately, but no municipalities or very few in most of the world are you know, providing for poor people,
yep.
in terms of housing. So, you know, this is not unique to New York City. But I'm encouraged that more people, it seems now, are you know, it's there's a phrase, self-determination, are taking, you know, are making this move and banding together and creating housing by any means necessary, whether it's wherever they're doing it, it's a beautiful thing.
I agree, and you know, I'd like to historically point out, during the Great Depression, we had these Hoovervilles, shanty towns. That were officially tolerated in the city. So, like, you could build a semi-permanent structure and put heat in it, and the city would leave you alone. So that actually today, things are worse in some ways than during the Great Depression because the cities tend to try and bust those things up. Like,
well, you have the repression. And this
that's
is what
right.
I was getting at.
Well, that's because there's a lot of money to be made out of taking back those
there.
Buildings, taking back that land.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
There
okay.
are those two focus. It's there's economic motives. And also, they want to keep all the Phillips and the women and the children, who are, by the way, the growing sector of homeless people, displaced former tenants, so women and children. But they want to keep people down, as Frederick Douglass pointed out. You know, if you teach a slave to read, that could be dangerous. Now, when you disempower whole communities that are organizing, whose schools are providing real education. cetera, et cetera. You disempower that. You destroy the housing. You dumb down the schools. You disinvest from the communities. You stop picking up the garbage. You look the other way when drugs are run into communities. It's a war against the poor.
Let me say to people who are out there, well, I have a couple things to say. First of all, these may be points that some of you out there disagree with. I hope you'll call in. I hope you'll call in at 877-NOBODY-8. But we want to present these points, not only because I personally believe there's a lot of truth to this, but because these are things that America is not hearing, and it's important for America to hear. By the way, if you're out there and you want to know what it looks like here on the scene, you can go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org, and there you'll see a webcam, and you can get some feeling for where we are out here in the rain in New Haven. At the microphone, I have someone. Would the person at the microphone tell me your name, please?
Hi, my name is Melissa Reddick.
Hi, Melissa. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to come out. I think this is a great thing that's going on. I'm not homeless, but I've been there. You know, for numerous years, I've been out on the streets due to drug and alcohol abuse. And I just want to speak on about the Clemens House and the other resources that New Haven have. You know, for me, my reasons for being homeless is because I had a drug addiction. And now that I'm in recovery, I'm taking heed and knowledge to the things that's offered in New Haven, that's available. You know, and for me, I think that the willingness and the faith and the hope that one has to have, they can get unstuck in the situation that they're in. You know, you don't have to be homeless for the rest of your life. You know, there's different things that can help you, you know, but you have to have that faith and a little bit of hope that somebody else out there that will help you. The Clemens House has a lot of things to offer. So they're wonderful, you know. To all over the world, whoever's homeless, you know, you don't have to be on the streets. You don't have to sleep in the car. You know, it's not that bad. You know, and it took me a long time to have that insight because I thought that when I was homeless that my life was over, you know, and I had to go to a lot of triumph and I endure a lot, you know, and just to start utilizing all the resources that you have and for me, stop allowing people to do my footwork and for me to start doing my footwork myself. You know, and that's just all basically what I want to say. I have came a little bit about me. I have came a long ways, you know. I've just gotten out of prison. You know, I'm affiliated with the Clemens House for many, many, many years, as I said. And I am a mentor here. I work here now, you know. And this is my dream, to help those that are in the predicament that I once was in, you know. And if I can give anybody a little hope, a little encouragement, that you don't have to stay stuck in where you're at, that you can rise above it, then my dream has come true, you know.
Melissa, I want to congratulate you on getting your life together. I want to congratulate you on having the drive to help others, which I think is beautiful. And I want to thank you very much for sharing that with us and for making that contribution.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
We've got someone on the line now from Cleveland also. Dave from Cleveland on the 877-NOBODY-8 line. Dave, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Nobody. I thought that I wanted to get a couple of comments in. Many of the details that you're bringing up are quite valid, but I do think that the scale is actually much larger and more intentional. In 1971 or two, they published the Club of Rome report, Limits to Growth. At that point, they looked at it and said, we can't afford more people, the big oligarchies that want to run everything. And the idea of building and growing industry to make yourself more wealthy, they all of a sudden realized that more billionaires and multimillionaires would mean that Cape Cod estates would turn to Cape Cod condos. So after that, when that came out, even as far back as Nixon, the term lifeboat ethics replaced the Green Revolution. Now we've seen control of the monetary scale. There is only so much purchasing power allowed to exist. With that, you can take and tell and define exactly how many people you want to ultimately have live. All you have to do is squeeze, and somebody's going to fall off the bottom.
That's right.
And the other thing I would like to point out, just personally, I think that that the prescriptions to drug use and so on, yes, people get off on it and stop doing other things. But I am reminded that many of the great jazz musicians and the Grateful Dead, what was Jerry Garcia, was a hard user of even heroin and still ran tours, was one of the nicest fellows in the entire rock industry. Everybody else was practically strip-searching patrons to make sure they weren't carrying tape recorders. He offered a plug to his mixing panel to anybody that wanted to tape. He was that open. Okay, and he ran those tours for decades, all the time.
He was a very nice guy. I interviewed him once. He was a very nice guy. And he's not the only one. The Beatles were known to use drugs every now and again, but... You know, I'm not censoring things here either. There are drugs issues that people have and alcohol issues. I don't think that is not the cause of homelessness by any means, but it is a reality and it's something that people want to talk about.
When they go out and decide to measure people's hair for cigarettes,
right,
tobacco, even, and drop them out of employability, they are using that as the mechanism of getting rid of population. They know they don't want 6 billion people, and they think they have the authority to say that there shall be less than that.
Well, you know, we don't have to put it that inflammatorily. What we can say is there's cherry picking going on, where businesses and whomever are seeking out certain individuals, and we no longer have an inclusive society where there's something for everyone. So if you're not making the cut, you're in trouble.
Well, but whether or not you decide to expand the total value of economy,
right,
and make it egalitarian is being set at a higher level than the individual businesses, medium scale, trying to scarf out what they think might be a best worker. And remember, some of this is imposed by government. If you want to take and get government contracts, medical industry contracts, you must often prove that your employees are checked.
Yeah, I know. There's this screening going on. Well, Dave, I want to thank you very much. I'm going to invite Frank to comment on what you've said when you're off the air, but I want to thank you very much for contributing this.
Good luck
thank you
to
so
all
much.
Your listeners.
Thank you. Frank, you got a comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the caller points out is what I would refer to as a certain kind of eugenics that, you know, it's kind of a scary notion that it's a kind of planning to eliminate large sections of the population. You know, we're certainly familiar with the Nazi use of that, of implementing that kind of strategy. But in terms of, like, let's just go back to the issue of homeless people, the demonization that has gone on of communities of color in particular who are homeless, look at somebody like Charles Murray and The Bell Curve. This is a book that came out, I guess, when, in the early 90s or so on, which contributed to the demonization of black people, particularly in terms of, the so-called genetic inferiority arguments or the violent in the genes thing and all that kind of thing. Murray was financed, and this again was reported in the New York Times and other places, in his writing of The Bell Curve, which is a book that, you know, attacks, targets the intelligence or lack of, according to Murray, of black people and furthers this demonization process and so on. He was financed in his writing by the Pioneer Fund. The Pioneer Fund is a neo-Nazi foundation and set up in 1937 and is well documented, has financed all kinds of horrendous things, including the anti-affirmative action legal firm in Washington, D.C. that brought the case to the Supreme Court. Again, you know, you don't have to. We're not talking conspiracy here. We're talking a
history.
Eugenics kind of a notion.
Let
pushed in a certain direction, which legitimizes the placing of hundreds of thousands of people in barrack warehouse shelters, in substandard housing, which even on a more psychological level, on a day-to-day level, allows for the day-to-day routine brutalization of people who live on the streets and who others who are quote-unquote more fortunate are forced to allow for and view and witness to. It's a dehumanizing process that affects everyone, because it's not only homeless people that are being dehumanized, it's people who are forced to allow for it. So, you know, it's this kind of notion that certain people are just worthless. And it's these are very dangerous ideas, and so it doesn't strike me as odd that it's potentially plausible that this kind of thinking goes on in these higher levels. I mean, you know.
Well, we don't know, of course, everything they're doing, but we do see the effects of what they're doing and what it amounts to. Frank and Francis, I'd like to share with you a little bit more math. In 2001, there were 2,649,523 people who were getting SSI and no other form of federal aid except maybe food stamps. And these people were the destitute, blind, disabled, or people over 65 years or older who had no other income. And they were getting an average of $435.38 a week. $435. That is a pittance. That's
not
why.
A week, a month.
What? I'm a sorry, month. A month. You're correct. That is a pittance. That's what we give to disabled people in this society. And who's getting the money they're not getting?
Well, you know, I want to make one point about demonization, brutalization of people. And that has to do with the theme of this hour, which is the profits that are made out of poverty. When a society degrades, stigmatizes, demonizes so many very, very poor people, the poorest of the poor, lots of other people who are nearly poor, who are close to poverty, are going to hold on as hard as they can and work as hard as they can. It's going to be much easier to get much more work from these people for very low wages. And so what we're talking about, which is the brutalization of some people at the very bottom, some people who are the worst off, has a lot to do with the fact that so many working people in the United States are doing so very badly.
Francis, I want to thank you. And Frank, I'm afraid we're out of time.
Thank you.
So
thank
I want to thank Frank Morales and Francis Fox Piven very much, both of you. Do you have a... I'll tell you what, you each got 5 seconds to say something. Francis?
I'm glad you did the program.
Thank you. Frank?
Yeah, people can contact me at frm@panix.com.
And if people want to tune in, they can go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org, find stations, find the webcast. Find the webcam. Oh, wait a minute. I'm now being told in my ear I have a minute and a half after I was just told that I had a minute. Well, let me ask you another question then. I got another minute. Francis, let me just turn it to you. What else would you like to cover?
Well, I think that what we're seeing in rising homelessness is the culmination of 25 years of very conservative policies. And the George W. Bush administration is promising to make it worse. If people don't begin to fight, to resist, to raise hell, we're in for very bad times.
Frank?
Yeah, I would second the notion. I think we need a combination of direct action through squatting and powerful organizations to negotiate for more affordable housing.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we really are out of time, and I think we've barely even scratched the surface of the topic. But I think what we can all agree on is if some group of people in our society are poor, that means that money is going somewhere else. Thank you both very much for being my co-hosts.
Okay, tonight. Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back.
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org.